Welcome to the Green Room, before multimedia, but actually it's going to be part of the programme because, of course, since last month, in fact, it's been a few months since we had a Green Room, isn't it, Mark? We sort of tended to forget it as we put the programme together, in a sense.
It's true. iTunes, of course, is what you're about to say. I'm taking the words
exactly,
out of your mouth.
Exactly, that's right, yes.
Shows we don't rehearse this stuff, does it?
I know. And the big thing with iTunes, I mean, they've added all sorts of extra bits. Only Microsoft used to play around with the technology and change the rules, but iTunes have done the same in terms of RSS tags, and so they've added loads of things to themselves, and I'm hoping to get the whole thing sorted out so you can end up very soon with a picture of Mark and I, which will be nice, and the things opening properly in iTunes. But at least we are there, and we have been since the beginning.
That's the thing that most impressed me, was that from the moment iTunes 4.9 launched, you could go straight to the podcast directory, type in multimedia, and up we pop.
That's right. But the downside from what we think is, and we daren't risk it on this one, is if you do more than one podcast a day, which, of course, if we do this with multimedia and have a separate Green Room, it ends up as two different podcasts. Whichever one we post last is the only one that's downloaded, and the other one just sort of stays there. I mean, you can see it's there if you really want to go into iTunes and then download it manually, but it doesn't come automatically. So for this one, we're putting the Green Room and multimedia together as one file. And if we can work out a way where we can ensure that the two things can be kept separately, it means that if you wish to, you can throw the Green Room away and keep multimedia, or vice versa, whichever, basically.
I'm just wondering, maybe we should ask the listener out there.
That's very true,
what
yes.
Would you prefer? Would you prefer the Green Room at the beginning of the show before we start the show proper, or would you prefer the two things completely separate so that we ramble on regardless to start with and then we start the show?
That's true, actually. I mean, I separated the Green Room from the Raven and the Blues programme simply because people said, look, I want the blues, I don't want to hear you chatting away beforehand, so I've kept those two separately. But yes, on this instance, I suppose the fact that multimedia is a talking programme means that the Green Room could just equally be added on as a sort of a prefix to it, couldn't it? So please let us know, and the best email address probably is the multimedia one, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, or you could use our Gmail address, which is bfbsmm for multimedia at gmail.com. That's BF for Freddy, BS for Sierra, MM at gmail.com, and that'll get to me, and I'll make sure we reply to everyone. It's been a busy old month, actually, hasn't it, Dave?
It has, very much, yes. And again, for the benefit of you listening via the podcast rather than on FM, once again, Mark and I aren't sitting facing each other, staring each other in the eye. We're doing this about 8 miles apart because you're heading off in about 10 hours, ten hours time on your holidays. Yeah.
Yes. This is the power of the internet. We actually, I knew I wanted a holiday, and we didn't have much time to sort it out. And literally yesterday afternoon, this would be Tuesday afternoon, I booked a holiday, and within just a little bit, 30 hours after that, we're going to be actually at the airport waiting to go on holiday.
Yeah, whereas, you know, not just content with booking a holiday, which normally would be a bit of a rush getting wife, son and everything else sorted out, you then also put together a multimedia programme as well. So,
well, let's face it, if Adam Curry could do it.
Yeah, that's true, yes. But I sometimes think Adam Curry's got more than 24 hours in the day, though.
Yes, he lives on a different different plane of existence, or
that's right, or his wife is just unbelievably tolerant and he doesn't do anything around the house at all. I mean, I've never really heard him talk about doing much in the way of housework apart from when she's away and he's looking after Christina, so
I bet you get some feedback on that one.
Yes, so anyway,
I'm waiting for Christina to grow up enough to babysit Sam, actually. there's some cross-fertilization going on
now. Quickly, just a quick look ahead then to September, when there's the UK podcasting convention. And we're both going to be there at that, aren't we? So we're not very far away from that, so we're looking forward to being there, and we'll have a better idea, I guess, of the amount of I think the iTunes release of podcasting has just meant, I mean, I know that from the sites I maintain, the demand has been unbelievable. So if it grows on like this, we're going to have to get more space and have bigger servers, I guess.
I mean, I think one thing they are thinking about is finding some way of sort of sharing the load by using some sort of torrenting system.
Well, iTunes... Well, BitTorrent works on multimedia because of the very kind hosts at libsyn.com who look after multimedia and all the other programs I look after. They are doing BitTorrenting work, so the BitTorrent is available for multimedia, but I'm not fully certain about how fully sort of conversant it is yet, but I know that there is a BitTorrent feed of multimedia should you wish it. And again, I know we've got some pretty expert listeners to this program, so if you want to help along with the BitTorrent side of it, we'd be more than happy to hear from you.
Indeed. And now, is it time to do the big announcement?
I think it is.
Okay. It's time for the July 2005 edition of BFBS Multimedia.
Accessing BFBS Multimedia.
Hello and welcome to Multimedia, your user-friendly guide to computers, the internet, and all the new technologies on 33 FM transmitters, on the BFBS Radio 2 Listen Again option, or as a podcast. Welcome to the show. I'm Dave Raven.
And I'm Mark Phillips. As the bombs went off in London, people turned to the internet like never before to find out exactly what was going on. So how did the BBC's website cope with the highest volume of traffic it's ever seen? I'll be finding out.
The TV and the PC are getting ever closer together, not just as a media centre, like Mark's just made, but as a box which sits under your television and plays movies, DVDs and music direct from your PC somewhere else in the house. I review the iHome.
I want one. And of course we've got the latest news from the world of technology with Paul Trotter from PC Pro magazine.
That's all coming up on Multimedia.
Multimedia.
Around the world, few people can fail to be moved by the events of Thursday the 7th. For me, I was sitting in my office and we're only 200, maybe 300 yards away from where the bus exploded. It was interesting to see just how the news was spreading. In an office situation in the past, you would have turned the radio on, maybe turned the television on, but it's interesting to see just how influential the internet has been on events such as this. The BBC site in particular, BBC News, has recorded its highest ever number of page impressions. They had something like, on the day, 115 million page impressions. How does a site cope with that? And indeed, the other thing that is really interesting is how the public have helped to gather information for sites such as this. Vicky Taylor is the editor of Interactivity at BBC News, and she joins Multimedia. Hello, Vicky.
Hello.
Obviously, you get very little notice of a major news event happening. All of a sudden, the world and his wife, they're all switching on their computers. Here in the office, we had about 10 people all trying to access the video feed from BBC News 24 across the BBC website. How do you cope with something like that?
It was clear on Thursday from about 10:30 in the morning that we were dealing with something extraordinary here. And what normally happens in situations like this when we expect high traffic is we use a third-party content delivery system and switch our graphics, our images, to their servers. What was happening on Thursday is the volume of traffic seemed to be so intense, we actually switched the whole site to their servers, which is an unusual step for us to take. The day before, in fact, which had been the day of the Olympic decision, we'd switched our graphics to their servers, and we've done that on the past. Indeed, the day after London's explosions, we did that again. But to actually switch our whole site to a third-party site for serving was quite an unusual step for us to take.
The demand must be immense, and it's an instant demand, isn't it? You have very little notice that you have to get things moving in a different way to normal.
Well, the interesting thing from our point of view is with the public, we're using our website to tell the story. As you may recall, when it first started, the London Underground were talking about power surges and events that were separated by, you know, up to an hour. What became clear from the emails coming into us was that actually the public were noting things were happening more or less simultaneously across London, and it was clear from the pictures that started to come in that this wasn't isolated events and was clearly becoming a terrorist attack.
This is probably the biggest news event that I can think of that's happened since technology, such as the fact that everybody seems to have a camera in their mobile phone. Some people have video phones now. Has that made a difference to what you're seeing from the public responding to you?
Well, Thursday, I think, was a turning point in how we report breaking news for broadcasting organisations, not just the BBC. Because what we saw, within less than an hour of the event happening, we had somebody sending in a photograph of the bus in Tavistock Square with the top blown off. And clearly, this was became the iconic image of the day. And later in the day, when we had the mobile phone footage of people walking along the tracks in the underground and people taking pictures in the carriages as they were trying to get out, this was reporting that we've never really seen before. We're used to sending our reporters to scenes to cover the story and tell the public what's happening. Here we had the public telling us we're in this horrible thing, horrible tragedy unfolding, and this is what I've been experiencing.
How do you actually cope with this sudden influx of content? In the past, it may have been phone calls. Now you're getting people sending pictures, they're sending videos. How do you sift through and respond and get this stuff out? Obviously, not just on the internet, but the BBC obviously runs various news channels as well, radio and television. How do you get this content out and publish it and show it to people?
Well, when breaking news is happening, as you probably know, a newsroom is all hands on deck, and clearly resources is going to be an issue for us in the future. Everybody switched to looking at this story. I have a small team, but we all were working on looking at the Your Picks folder, yourpicks@bbc.co.uk, and the emails were flooding in. I think by the end of the second day, we'd had 20,000 plus emails, and by the end of the first day, we'd had 1,000 images to the BBC.
Do you think that the nature of news reporting of a major incident has changed now by the fact that everybody is now a reporter? If you're armed with a mobile phone and it's got a camera on it, that's it. You're there, as opposed to having to send a reporter there. You're just there at the scene of something global.
Well, I think it was a turning point in how we report news, most definitely. We've always known that the public can give you an inside view onto stories that reporters can't capture. And we've known that after 9/11, when we had all the emails from New York at the time. We've seen that with the tsunami earlier this year, when people were capturing video of the wave, of what was happening to them in that region. But the explosions in London were on a far greater scale and with much more impact, really, because it was so instant and so harrowing, a lot of it happening underground. So the images that were coming through of people's, you know, attempts to get out of the tube trains seemed to be so much more graphic. And the fact that it was then used, we had our processes in place to get that material onto our TV outlets, onto our News 24 channel and our domestic bulletins, that meant that a greater audience was seeing this material, and it became so much more of a public story.
Is there a degree of editorial responsibility where you look at a picture and you say, that's just too graphic?
We did have several instances of people, particularly in the Tavistock Square area, of sending pictures which were just too graphic for us to use on the website and TV outlets. And certainly there's a few images that were inappropriate of people in harrowing and distressing conditions that we wouldn't want to publish. So yes, we were aware of the sensitivities and the fact we were publishing pictures of an event that many people hadn't realised had happened that morning. So we took all of that into consideration. But nevertheless, we still published a number of images sent to us which showed the devastation in the Tavistock Square area and what was happening underground that were acceptable to us, but still were pretty harrowing images themselves.
What lessons were learned from the BBC News, BBC I teams from this?
I think the fact that, you know, over 100 million people accessed the site that day in a breaking news story is proof we can do it, and that has certainly moved us on from where we were 5 years ago, say. But in terms of dealing with the public's material, we were at the very early stages of how to cope with that and had a few systems in place, but nothing really to cope with the load. So what we need to do now is obviously look at how we manage this in the future and how we get the material, particularly video and still images, to the outlets like television and for emails to the radio outlets as quickly as possible.
Vicky Taylor, the editor of Interactivity from BBC News, thank you very much for joining us on Multimedia.
Thank you.
I mean, the thing which has staggered me is that, I mean, we heard there from Vicky about the sheer demand the BBC website was under, and they weren't alone. Every news website was hit so dramatically. But it's been the aftermath for me. And the difficulty we have with multimedia is that if you're listening to it on the first transmission on the Wednesday, it's almost 2 weeks after the event. And, of course, if you're listening via a podcast or on the internet, it could be up to a month or even longer after the event. But those immediate days afterwards, for me, the really strong, the number of websites that sprang up, And I'm not a person who sort of is moved to tears easily, but there are a couple of sites, if you haven't been to them, you're bound to have heard them mentioned. We'renotafraid.com, I think it's just, there's some funny ones there, but it's just, it actually brings me to tears when you see some of the photographs on we'renotafraid.com. And there's one website which I think is so good. It's on the BBC page. I don't know whether you've been following it, Mark. It's a survivor's story of how she was in one of the trains that with the bomb, and she's written a daily blog. And it actually does bring me to tears. It's really superbly done. And if you want to get a feel of what it's been like in London, the final website to mention, we'll put them all on the multimedia website, is Flickr, where they've got some staggering photographs, some amazing photographs that people took. That's flickr.com. But we'll put all these links on the website, because it really has made blogging and the internet come alive, hasn't it?
It has. I mean, it was interesting that within literally minutes of this, finding out that something was going on, there was like eight or nine people around me all trying to access the BBC News website at the same time. And it suddenly made me think, well, if this is replicated in offices around London and then around the world, it really does need to cope with an enormous amount of demand for that news, a voracious appetite. And we were lucky in a way, well, they were lucky that the Americans were asleep when it happened.
That's right. But the BBC site stayed sort of coping with it, but quite a few other sites just gave up, didn't they?
Yeah, the notable one, in fact, was Transport for London, where you go for information about London Underground and London buses, where they pulled their entire site off the web and went down to just a single text page, which pretty much said, forget it, get a boat or walk, was pretty much the advice they gave. And that they literally pulled their entire site, route finders, the lot, all disappeared from the web.
I think whereas the events of September the 11th also had an impact on the internet, because the internet has matured so much and is maturing every year, this event, terribly traumatic though it has been, has actually again been an indication of just how powerful the internet can be in bringing people together, in sharing and helping things through. And if you want to get a feel of what it's been like to be in London, or to be a London, or to be British, there's some wonderful sites. It's worth spending some time on the internet, I would guess. Anything that springs out to you, Mark, about the places that you may have seen over the last week or so?
Really, it was just the atmosphere in London itself. I mean, living and working in the heart, living in London, working in the heart of central London. A friend of mine had one incident at one end of her street, and the bus bomb at the other. Was unable to get home for several hours. Didn't really know what to do with herself, because she ended up going in a huge circular route just to get home. But luckily, at the time of recording, it seems things have calm down a bit in the town.
This is BFBS Multimedia.
Competition time on Multimedia, and as always, we look back at last month. In fact, this month we don't have a prize at all, because it is the summer silly season. Everybody's away, back to normal in August. But let's look back at last month, and we were giving away what we thought was just going to be some sort of mal security software, but things are much better than that, aren't they?
Yes, indeed. What's happening is that I think we mentioned on the show that Spy Subtract has now been brought up by Trend Micro, and they're actually going to be launching a new product. So although we said we were going to give you copies of Spy Subtract, we're not, but we will give you copies of the new product as and when it's launched. But in the meantime, those rather nice people at Trend Micro have sent us copies of Trend Micro PC Cillin Internet Security 12, which is antivirus, firewall, and general safety features for the internet, which you can have in the meantime. So you get two prizes for the price of one.
So this is like an interim prize before the main one comes, is
exactly,
that right?
Before the new product comes out, and then you'll be one of the first people to get the new product as and when it's released by Trend Micro.
Sounds rather good. A double prize then. We've got four winners. Let's go through. Start first with you, Mark. Pick one out of the hat.
Okay, first one out. We better give the answer, actually, which
was... That's true. Yes.
What does the MAL in spyware stand for? And it's, of course, malicious, or it could be MAL in French for sick, I suppose.
Yeah.
But Mark Quince, DEFM, DEOBU, BFSAI, BFPO 655.
An address full of acronyms. Well done, Mark. My next one, or my one out is Chris Butler. Mine's all acronyms too, actually. GWA, MB64, Hona Garrison, BFPO 30. Well done, Chris.
Okay, I'm just going to scroll down here, and the next one is John Fleming, and the Fleming family from RAF Akrotiri works in the DDS Dental Centre at BFPO 57. Smile, please. Look at those lovely teeth.
And finally, Nick Cheatham. Well done, Nick. You're with HQ ARRC BFPO 40. You'll all receive your first prize, and then, of course, a follow-up a bit later on from Trend Micro. But as I mentioned, we've got no prize this month because it's July. Everybody's away. Back to normal again for next month in the August edition of Multimedia.
BFPS Multimedia.
Next on Multimedia, the Home Entertainment Centre. If you're a regular listener, you will know that for the last 3 months, Mark has been building his own PC version of that, a large, attractive black box that basically, effectively, is not only his home PC, but also that's where he stores all of his movies, his entertainment, his pictures, and his audio, and it's played back through his home hi-fi and home television system. The jury's still out about whether this idea is going to develop and take off, or whether, in the end, in the future, we'll still have a box under the television and a PC that we do play our games and write our emails on. But more and more components are now becoming available which can convert your PC into a home entertainment centre. If you're, again, a regular listener, you'll know I'm a Mac person. And if I had a pound for every time somebody had said to me over the years, oh, you know, I wouldn't mind a Macintosh, except they're much more expensive, and you can't get the software and the hardware, I'd be a very rich man. And whereas it was true some years ago that Macs were more expensive, if you compare apples with apples these days, and compare, say, a Mac with a quality PC, like an IBM or a Compaq, you'll find that the price point is pretty similar. In terms of software, I've been using Macs for 20 years, and there's very few applications that I can't get. Having said that, I've just got a Garmin Quest sat-nav system, and that, of course, only works on a PC. And in terms of hardware, it's probably the one area where there are more add-ons, plugins, and things you can get for your PC than there are for a Macintosh. For my review this month, I'm going to do a bit of Mac hardware, but don't switch off if you're a PC person, because everything I'm going to talk about applies to something like that for the PC. It's made by Elgato, and it's called iHome. Now, Elgato originally brought out a little box you plugged into your Mac, about 3 years ago, called the USB iTV, and that enabled you to record television programs onto your computer, and you could then watch them on your computer, or take all the commercials out and burn them to a CD or a DVD and watch them on your television set somewhere else in the house. Now, I got one when it first came out and I was really impressed with it. Elgato have improved their range over the years. They now have a Freeview digital ITV box, which enables you to record all of those free-to-air digital programs. But their latest edition, which came out towards the end of last year, is called iHome. And it's sort of, if you like, a complimentary box. But this time it doesn't fit next to your PC, it fits next to your television. And the two things talk to each other. And Elgato lent me their iHome digital media player for me to review. It's a very neat box. It's not very large. It doesn't have to be. It's got very few controls. After all, it's got a remote control, which enables you to flick through all the various features that are on it, but it's only just about the size of a large video cassette. It's in anodized aluminium, it looks very pretty, and it sits somewhere near your television set. The only problem that I found, and you might find too, is that with all the things I've got under the television set, which all have to plug into it, I was running out of SCART sockets. I resolved that with the Smart SCART, which, if you want to find out more about that, I reviewed last month on the Gadgets programme, G3. Just go to bfbs.com/G3 and you can see the Smart SCART and how that works. But effectively all you do is you plug this iHome into your television set, and then with the software on your computer talks to your television set. Now the two units talk to each other either by connecting by wire or wirelessly. Now of course wires are okay if they're close enough, but if you've got to get from one room down the corridor, up and down the stairs and into another, that's not really practical. And wireless networks are becoming fairly ubiquitous now and are not tremendously expensive, and that's how I've connected my iHome to our television set in the downstairs room with a wireless network. The software is a joy to use, and this is where I suppose I do digress away from other applications you can get for a PC. So this is kind of for the Mac listeners alone. The software is just a joy to use. You load it in your system and switch it on and say, please, you know, connect with the iHome, and then that's it. And then down at your television set, you switch across to whichever SCART channel you've plugged it into, and there it is. All the movies, all the videos, all your images, all the audio, audio, everything that you've got on your computer, which is, if you like, in a roundabout generic term, entertainment, can now be available on your television set. The screens are very easy to operate. You use the mouse to use the up and down arrows and the left and right arrows to get into the various features, and then just hit the play button and away it goes. And it's just seamless to operate. Previously, as I mentioned, I have the iUSB TV thing, and what I'd been doing for the previous almost 3 years now is making DVDs and then taking them downstairs, and then as we play the watch the various programmes, crossing them off, and then bring the DVD back upstairs to wipe and start again. But nowadays, they don't have to do that at all. It's because everything is just readily available. In terms of pricing, the Elgato iHome Wireless Edition, so you need to buy nothing else down at the far end next to your television, is just over £200. Of course, you have to have wireless at the other end where your Macintosh is, but in most cases, you do have that anyway. And if you're thinking about buying the iTV, they start at about £90 or thereabouts. The ease of use is wonderful. My iTV, when I first got it 3 years ago, has revolutionised the way that we watch television in the Raven household. I don't think I've seen a commercial for years, because I cut them all out, which is perhaps not the best news for advertising companies. But if you are thinking about going along this route, I can strongly recommend it. If you're a Mac person, the Elgato systems are worth looking at. You'll find their website at Elgato, ELGATO.com, and they are a European company. You'll find the prices in euros as well as in pounds and in dollars. And if you're a PC person and thinking, well, that's all a waste of time, Raven, it's not, in the sense that it's worth looking out. There are lots of companies out there making something similar. I don't think for such a quite a nice interface as the Elgato have put together, mind you, but there are lots of things out there that are pretty similar. And again, it just frees you up from having to set the video recorder and all of those nauseous ramifications. It all done on the computer and then sent wirelessly down to your television set. It is the future. The only problem that I've now got is I've got to pack it all up and send it back to Elgato back in Europe.
Multimedia news.
Well, it's certainly been a busy show, and of course a busy time in London. I'm here at the offices of PC Pro, and I'm talking to news and features editor Paul Trotter, who joins us again on Multimedia. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
First of all, well, I suppose as we started off the programme talking about the events in London on the 7th, we can't really fail to mention them at the end as well. The BBC was saying that their website's got double the amount of hits in a single day than it's ever had before. Is the internet able to cope with this sort of huge demand?
It's always interesting to see what happens with the news websites when these sort of things happen. I think a few years ago, the September 11th disaster, lots of people looked to the internet then, and it was actually mentioned by many people as the first time people took the internet as a news source seriously. And once again, 2 weeks ago, everybody was piling onto the BBC News website, myself included, and it coped pretty well. I was able to get to the page and get to the news stories, but it was, of course, a lot slower than it would be normally.
What's happened this time round, I suppose because of technology, is that for the first time, all around me, like there were 10 people in my office, and they're all trying to get to the video feed of News 24 and watching it on their computer. So the amount of demand must have been phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure if the news feed in terms of the video is set up for that much demand, because I couldn't actually pick it up. So I think in terms of the flat text pages, that's obviously easier to deliver to people. But the video, of course, requires a lot more bandwidth. So, in fact, I couldn't see that. But once somebody did get hold of that, everyone was, of course, piling around their machine.
The other thing that came out of our conversation earlier in the show is the fact that people are now becoming reporters, if you like. They're becoming the source of the breaking news. They were texting, they were sending their mobile phone pictures, and you will have seen some quite harrowing mobile phone video actually appearing on air, which was sent in by viewers.
Yeah, of course, everybody nowadays is a reporter with blogging and texting. In fact, the mobile phone networks weren't responding quite as well as the internet in that respect, although some texts and pictures got through. Many of the networks weren't working, and you couldn't phone people up. But of course, the internet, in terms of email and blogs on the internet, were working, and you could probably get more information there than from anywhere else.
Moving away from that subject now, although staying with the internet, the next generation of internet could be with us soon in the form of ADSL 2+. This is almost the new version of broadband, broadband 2, super broadband.
Seems every month we're talking about broadband speeds, and the next thing to look forward to is, as you say, ADSL 2+, which is promising 24 megabits per second connection speeds. They've been talking about this summer, but I'd be suspicious about that I think before the end of the year, though, some people in certain areas will be able to access it. The danger is, of course, that it creates another kind of digital divide. It wasn't so long ago that we were talking about the difference between dial-up and broadband. Now we're going to be talking about the difference between 24 megabits and people that can only get 5, 12 or 1 megabit.
With 24 megabits, doesn't that open up a whole new area of what you can do live online? I mean, I would assume that's fast enough to stream television in good enough quality to watch it pretty much on any sort of TV set without having it in a little window.
Indeed. I mean, lots of the companies interested in this area have been talking about TV over the internet for quite a long time and suggesting that the current speeds would support that, but we think that you probably need at least 4 megabits per second to watch TV live. So, of course, 24 megabits would be plenty enough for that. Whether you actually need that much, I'm not sure, but, of course, all these fast speeds are going to capture people's attentions, aren't they?
I know details of the actual systems they're going to be using are still fairly sketchy, but will it be using the same copper wire that's currently carrying ordinary broadband?
Yes, in theory. The only difference is the companies that are backing it are going to be putting different equipment into BT's exchanges, which is quite a costly process. So they actually go into the exchanges and put their own equipment in there, so they actually own the network to some degree. But it does basically run on the same copper cabling that we've been using for several years.
Technology, don't you love it? And finally, something that we have mentioned on the show many times, Skype, which is the internet-based phone service. They've got some new bits and pieces coming out.
Yeah, Skype and VoIP is another buzzword for this year, and now we're going to be seeing video over Skype calls. It's actually a third-party company that's linking something onto Skype's system. So you'll be able to see who you're talking to, in theory, up to 200 people, they're saying. The beta's already released. It's called Video Skype, or VSkype, and I think a full product's going to be available later this summer, although the beta version will still be available, but only limiting you to 4 people at a time.
I'm sure that's enough, except for the grossest pornographic purposes, which, of course, we can't talk about on the show. That's going to drive it, obviously. And there's also moves to integrate Skype into your Outlook address book as well.
Yeah, that's an early version of that's available too. One or two bugs, we believe, at this stage, but it'll mean that you'll be able to call people directly from your Outlook address book and also into Internet Explorer, so you'll be able to see how much credit you've got left in your Skype calls.
Sounds like a good thing. Watch this space. For news of all the breaking technology stories, do have a look at pcpro.co.uk. That's pcpro.co.uk. Paul Trotter, news and features editor of PC Pro, thanks very much.
Thanks.
And that's almost it for Multimedia for July. Another packed programme, but as we speak, you're jetting off to foreign climes.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because I'll be listening back to this programme. I'm going to see if I can log on. I'm actually going off to 2 weeks in Rhodes with Wendy and Sam and just looking for a break, really.
Well, I hope you have a wonderful time. 2 weeks in the Greek islands sounds absolutely magnificent. I could use a break. Before we go, a quick mention about iTunes. Now, you don't have to have an iPod to be able to use iTunes, and an iTunes works on both a Mac and a PC, and it's free, so you can go to the Mac site and download the one for the Mac or the one for the PC. And the reason why I'm telling you all this is that iTunes, in this last month, since we spoke last, has launched podcasting as an option. Normally with iTunes, you put all your own music from your CDs into it, or you can buy things from the iTunes Music Store and store them again on your computer. But now it's got podcasting, which is free, of course. And Multimedia, as you would imagine, as a technology program, is along there, available in iTunes, along with the Gadgets programme G3 and SitRep, and also the very best of the speech interviews from BFPS Radio 2, which includes, of course, this programme. And the way to get it, basically, is go to the Mac site and get iTunes. As I say, it's free. And then, even if you don't use it for an MP3 player, you don't have to have an MP3 player. All you've got to do is just click into Podcasts, and then in the search engine there, type in BFBS and wait. And eventually, you'll see at present 4 different BFBS podcasts. There's the Gadgets Programme, G3. There's SitRep with Christopher Lee. There's the Best of BFBS Radio 2. And there's BFBS Multimedia. And if you just click on that one and click on Subscribe, I know some people get confused about Subscribe because it implies money's involved. You know, if you take a subscription out to a magazine, that normally costs you. But this is a free Subscribe, so you needn't worry. And what happens then is whenever there's a new Multimedia, bing, it automatically appears on your computer in your iTunes, and you can listen to it whenever you like. And so instead of being constrained by listening on FM or on Listen Again, which still means you've got to be tied to the computer, this gives you a lot more freedom. If you need further information, just drop me a line, dave.raven@bfbs.com or multimedia@bfbs.com, and we'll answer your questions. But you will find Multimedia as one of the few professional talk radio podcasts, and we've been there since last October, which is rather pleasing. Don't forget also that Multimedia has a website, which you'll find at bfbs.com/multimedia, and there you'll find links to everybody we've talked to and about in this month's programme, both Elgato and the BBC site, and the other sites that I recommend that have sprung up, if you like, since the events of the 7th of July, and also links to the Listen Again and podcasting features of the programme. So, until next month, from me, Dave Raven.
And from me, Mark Phillips.
Bye-bye.
Ta-ra.